How many World War II veterans will you find performing on stage for the next 3 weeks? Well, I know of at least one, and we'll meet him today at 1 on Hometown Heroes.
I'd be playing the role.
You were born to do it.
That was my life's ambition.
We'll find out what he did in the Navy during World War II, his unique recollection about Pearl Harbor Day, and I'll tell you when and where you can see him on stage. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every weekend here on KMJ, whether you're listening on the AM side of your dial, on the FM side, or online at kmjnow.com. You know that we visit with veterans every week, mostly from our World War II generation. They come in so many different shapes and sizes, so many different specialties, so many different experiences during the war, and maybe most interesting, such different lives after the war was over. And it's so fascinating for me to go along on that journey and listen to how things unfolded for these young men and occasionally women who were willing to step up, wear a uniform, and put their lives on the line during the most turbulent time in global history, really. We're going to visit today with a guy who's been acting for most of his 87 years. And in fact, you'll have a chance to see him act this week. Friday night is the opener for The New Wrinkles, their silver anniversary tour. That is at Fresno City College. If you've never seen him before, here's your invitation. We're going to hear all about it from our guest today, Ken Green, only 87 years young. And how old were you when you started acting, Ken?
Well, I was about 5 years old, but this was in a very small community, and my grandmother had a small little company, and of course her grandson and have a youngster role. I'd be playing the role.
You were born to do it.
That was my life's ambition. Of course, I got, you know, when I went into the service and everyone says, "Hey, Ken, that's a rough life. Why don't you do something like being an engineer?"
Mm-hmm.
So when I applied to come to school down here, I started out as an architectural engineer, but the University Street Playhouse drug me over there.
No matter
and
what
that
you
was
tried.
It. That yeah. was it. I was back in theater.
And you haven't been able to escape since. And starting this week, you can actually see Ken and his daughter as part of the same production. We're going to talk more about it. But I'll try to stay in chronological order if I can, Ken. So you grew up in Northern California in a town called Etna.
In a little town called Etna.
How big a town was that at that time?
Oh, it was about 4 or 5, I don't know, that it was a small town. We graduated high school. My high school graduation were 22 of us.
22?
22 graduates.
Wow. So pretty small town.
It was at one time very large because where 99 is used to come down through the valley and come through Etna, which was kind of a high point because there you go over Sawyer's Bar and on down to Redding. Mm-hmm. And it was the gold country time.
Far Northern California.
Yeah.
So during the gold rush, this was a hopping place.
Oh, it really was.
Yeah.
And a lot of going through. But then when they changed the road and came down through the canyon, they cut out the old route down through there. So kind of left us back in what I call now Paradise Lost.
Absolutely, because you live here now, but we think this is a pretty paradise kind of area of our state too. And I've been through that neck of the woods. It really is woods up in that part of California. And the thing you can't miss if you go through there now is just about every corner there's a statue of Bigfoot. So I've got to ask you, did you ever see Bigfoot up in Etna?
Well, you know, I did a lot of camping and outdoors. I was a scoutmaster for a while, and I'd go in, and every now and then I'd spot Bigfoot. Then I'd wake up. just never had his acquaintance. Although I heard a lot about him even then.
I'm sure you did, and you still will now. You did encounter something a little more fierce than Bigfoot once you would end up in the Navy. But before we get to that, so here you are in this small town. You're acting from the age of five, and I think people can hear in your voice. This is something you love to do. You love to perform, and you know how to tell a story.
Oh, I can tell a story. In the days when I was more looted. Now things escape me. You're never going to tell when all of a sudden I'll start rambling about something I haven't the foggiest notion what I'm talking about. It comes with the territory, I think.
Well, hopefully we won't have too many of those moments in this hour on the radio. So I'll try to direct you if I can and take your myriad memories back to a date that seems to live in everyone's memory who was alive then, December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out?
I sure was. We were, my dad and mom and my little sister and I went out to look for our Christmas tree. We had to go up in the hills there. We had to cut our own trees then, you know.
Plenty to choose from.
Yeah. And we got our tree, and coming back, and somebody honked at us, and we stopped, and they said, "Have you heard the news?" "What are you talking? We just got our Christmas tree." Pearl Harbor was bombed, and that was that was the start of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even in that little town.
Yeah, I'm sure it spread quickly.
Oh, very quickly.
I won't use the like wildfire analogy because that's a real
term.
Danger. Yeah. So you're 15 years old at the time, and I'm sure some of the people that you were going to school with started to sign up.
Well, I started a year younger than most because to begin the first grade, they didn't have enough, and they asked my parents, could Ken come to start first grade with the so we can have enough to have a first grade? So I was a year ahead of most of my classmates.
Very young for your grade.
Yeah. Got along fine.
So after Pearl Harbor, and then you're continuing on in high school, and I guess you thought about enlisting, but you found another job that was going to suit you better?
Oh, well, I did my part, you know, as far as doing the things for the war effort, you know, and then came the time I was a senior, but I wasn't 18 in time for the draft, and the town was very small, and they worked arrangements out with the Automobile Association and everybody, and I got a job as a bus driver.
A 17-year-old school bus driver.
Right. and as I was doing dramatics, then so I went back as a postgraduate as a bus driver and to help the English teacher with the senior play that year. So I was just having a ball. So then when I turned 18, I got the message, "Ken, it's time for you now to be part of the big show." So
signed Uncle Sam.
That's, yeah.
The big show
the
being
big
World
show.
War II.
Right.
That's quite the show. And it's not all fun and games either.
That's for sure.
So it was off to the Navy.
Right.
So I'm guessing from Etna, I guess the closest thing you can have to a boat would be a fishing boat on the river, nothing like a Navy ship.
Well, hardly.
Yeah?
And I don't know why. I've always thought, well, one of my friends wanted to go into Annapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And I like stories about the ocean. I think I would prefer to be in the Navy rather than the Army. That way you're always going to have a bunk to sleep on. And you
no foxholes on a ship.
No foxholes on the ship. So my first endeavor was up at Farragut.
That's working, in Idaho.
Yeah. Working the long boats and shoveling until my arms, I thought, were going to fall off.
Was that a tough adjustment for you when they broke you in? Because here you'd been driving school kids around in a bus and teaching them how to act, and all of a sudden they probably had some demanding things for you to do.
Oh, I don't know. It was tough. I just went along with, you know, this is what you do. This is what, and so I just made the most of it, and I was assigned to the amphibian forces out there in the Navy. So that's how I ended up with the amphibians.
And the ship that you would end up on was an attack transport, the USS Pickaway, APA 222.
Right.
When did you first lay eyes on that beauty?
Well, we were at Treasure Island waiting for an assignment. And when I got the notice, I was to go over to Mare Island, Vallejo, to the Kaiser, where they were commissioning this new attack transport. I boarded it there, and we went through its shakedown cruises, and then until we ended up in San Diego to pick up the troops. But the most dangerous time our ship was in, I think, was when we were doing our shakedown. I was a signalman, and I'd learned all these things, the semaphores and the flags and the lights and the whole bit, you know. And while we were doing our shakedown, there was a message came through from the coast here to identify ourselves or something, and it was on with the lights. And I was still having a little difficulty. The first ship I'd been on, you know, I'd learned all these things and everything. And I got the wrong message, and there was an old salt, and we call them old salts. They may be a few years older than us, but they went through some of the toughest times of the war. They were old salts. And he was up there, and he looked over. He said, "Oh, my God, let me get on." So he got on the light and got us squared away. But they were beginning to train the guns on us to blow our ship.
Because with the Morse code of using the lights to do the
right, yeah,
you had signaled the wrong identification, or
no? I says I think I got your message. I don't know what you're talking about, but you know I don't know what you. And boom, then they started. Well, supposedly I was supposed to have answered in a certain way. I forgot how that was now, but I got it all mixed up. The story of my life.
So you almost got your brand new ship blown out of the water.
We got blown up there before we even got a good start.
Well, good thing the old salt was there to save your bacon.
Exactly.
Did you continue with those duties, or did they find something else for you to do?
Oh, no. I was a signalman quartermaster the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to get the feel of it a little bit more. Not too much did I work with the light. I had trouble with my eyes distinguishing the dots and the flashes and the you know, back and forth, distinguish them how long these lights were. So most of mine were semaphore and the flags.
And we've had some veterans on this show that dealt in the same thing, but I think some people might be saying semaphore. What is that? Is that like a 2x4? Is that like a 4x4?
But, no, a very small 2x4. No, it's a little stick with a flag on it, and you stand there and give your this is the way you communicated. Well, when the boats with the troop going in, then you signal back and forth with them.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so that's what the semaphore was mostly, because when you communicate with the other big ship, you'd use the flag hoist, you know, messages for everybody.
Right.
But so this was more or less for just small communications where it didn't want radio signals, and you could talk to the troop aboard the landing craft as it went in, directing them.
And has that stuck with you? If I showed you a picture of a guy holding the flags in a certain position, would you know what it meant?
I'm not sure if I remember that alphabet. That was a long time ago. I have even difficulty sometimes when they ask me what my name is.
Well, I heard it was Ken Green, so I hope that's accurate.
Oh, yeah, that was. I had my own little special flags. But they recognized me. I really didn't like standing up there and being a sore thumb, you know, on up there on the bridge signaling them.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept trying to find places where I'd be out of out of a shot if anything is coming through. But they seemed to know where I was at when I got the messages to them. Fortunately, the troop that we took in, well, it wasn't the initial troops that went in, but we were, you know, the third group that went in.
And he's talking about Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima, that was the...
We're going to talk about that. It's about time for our first commercial break here, but when we come back, we'll talk about not a semaphore flag, but another flag that Ken saw that we've all seen a photo of, but he actually saw it with his own two eyes atop Mount Suribachi. So we'll discuss that story when we come back. We'll also explore the rest of his experiences in the Navy and remind you where you can see him in action, performing in the theater right here in Fresno this coming week. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes next on KMJ.
With Memorial Day approaching, EECU reminds us to honor the greatest generation.
Hi, I'm Paul Leffler, and there's nothing I enjoy more than honoring our hometown heroes from the greatest generation. That's why I'm so excited that Honor Flight, a nonprofit organization that flies World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C., is coming to our valley. I'm thrilled to tell you that my friends at EECU will be giving them an incredible head start. For every qualifying auto loan between now and Memorial Day, EECU will make a $50 donation to help establish Central Valley Honor Flight. They're even offering a special rate to sweeten the deal.
Hurry in to EECU by Memorial Day to get financing as low as 1.99% APR on new and used autos, and EECU will donate $50 to Central Valley Honor Flight.
In World War II, all gave some, and some gave all. Let's come together and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
Rates subject to change. Some restrictions apply. Federally insured by NCUA.
EECU. Smarter banking since 1934.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 87-year-old Ken Green of Fresno, California, Navy veteran of World War II. He served on an attack transport, the USS Pickaway, APA 222. And we mentioned the words Iwo Jima before we left off. We're going to explore that with Ken. Remember, if you're taken by his great radio voice and the drama that it can contain, maybe you want to see him on the stage, and you can do that at New Wrinkles. They're celebrating their 25th anniversary. Ken and his daughter are both part of the show. I'll ask him more about that later. But that opens this coming Friday night at 7:30 over at Fresno City College. If you want more information, I've got it linked on our website at kmjnow.com. And the web address for New Wrinkles is newwrinklesfresno.com. So take a look at that. And if you want to see what Ken looks like and you can't make it out there, you can go to our website, kmjnow.com. I'll throw a photo up there of this smiling 87-year-old who's been acting most of his life. And he's glad he's had a rest of his life because he was in harm's way during World War II. We heard about the shakedown cruise that he says was the scariest moment, and that's counting heading over to Iwo Jima. So let's talk about this. You turn 19 in February of 1945, and I guess that's about when you guys headed out that way, huh?
Well, around that time, numbers and dates are nemesis to me. But anyway, that sounds pretty good to me. Around that time anyway. But it was after the shakedown cruise that we were sent to San Diego to pick up the troops. Mm-hmm. Not knowing, we didn't have the foggiest notion what was going on. We just got a shipload of troops.
You didn't know where you were going. You just knew you were going.
No. And we were out there. That was months that we took a long time for the invasion fleet to gather, you know, and work together till we went in. There was a lot of communications in between ships, you know.
Sure. And you were involved in those communications.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah. We're off to, you know, give us messages, send to another ship.
And your ship was there to unload and receive.
So, to take the troops in. And so, fortunately, we weren't the first group that went in.
Right.
That's a hairy one. Mm-hmm. But we were the second or third when we took and disembarked our troops to go on. And so we were there until they raised the flag there on Mount Suribachi, you know.
And to paint a picture for people, so you're on this ship, and then on that ship are many of these boats, Higgins boats, as they're commonly called, the LCVPs, and maybe even some other landing craft.
Yeah, we just called them a landing craft.
Yeah. And so they would take the soldiers to the beach while you guys waited offshore.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you had, I guess, probably about 1,500 soldiers on that ship that were going to be taken to Iwo Jima?
I think there were 6 landing barges off our ship that took the troops in.
And did you interact much with those guys, the Army guys?
That's the one where I would use my semaphore. Okay, slow down. We're going in there now, you know. I forgot what I said, but talk to them on the boats. There would be a signalman on the boats, and then they were from the ship to them. Now there's that another group coming in from another, you know, from one of the other landing.
And I've talked to some folks who operated those landing craft. In fact, one of the guys who operated the landing craft at Iwo Jima is still in town. Was the president of Fresno City College, where you're going to be performing this week.
Oh.
Dr. Clyde McCauley was landing some of those troops. And one of the things I've heard about is how difficult it was to land there because of the tides.
Yeah.
Did you guys, as far out as you were, did you have rocky seas to deal with?
Well, they were pretty. Yeah, I never, not that rocky to me when we were out there. I brought them in. The guys, I remember the guys when I was communicating, they say it's pretty rocky going in here.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it. That was a long time ago.
Yeah. And here you are, 19 years old, and here's boats full of guys your same age that are going in, and I'm sure it crosses your mind that they might not be coming back.
Well, yeah. At the time, you don't think about that so much until we took them in, but our ship got damaged in the bow. We were also scheduled to go on to Okinawa, but being we had damage, they sent us back to Pearl and then brought some of the troops out, particularly those that were well enough to be transported back in our ship rather than the hospital ship. So we brought them, took them in, and then we brought them out when we got.
And I want to ask you some more questions about that, but while we're on the topic of Iwo Jima itself and the weeks that you spent there, because if the records I looked at are correct, you guys got to Iwo Jima in the middle of March, about the 14th. Mm-hmm. Were there, I guess, for about a week and got to Pearl Harbor the first week of April?
Something like that. The dates and things, this is kind of a blur right now.
But I bet what's not a blur, I bet what you can remember is what you saw there when you were off the coast of Iwo Jima. What can you paint that picture for us, what you actually witnessed? I mean, did you see bombers flying over? Did you see shells flying? What did you see?
Mostly the planes weren't hitting, but sure, things were still active. But what we could see from our ship is these caves that the enemy were in, throwing the flamethrowers in there and imagining the devastation that was going on. And I was never one for killings or guns or anything. That's why one of the reasons I chose the Navy too, because I'm not of that category. And
but so you had no choice. You were seeing it.
You're right. Yeah.
And so you're on this ship just off of this island, and were there some binoculars there, a glass that you could look through to get a closer view?
That's how we could, up there on the bridge where I spent the time as a signalman quartermaster. In fact, that was about the only part of the ship I was ever in. We'd have these big telescopes that you could just bring them practically like they were next door to you.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to see that action, that much of the action. But that was about the action that we got to see mm-hmm. there.
And you, looking through that scope, you saw maybe the most famous flag in the history of the world.
I think that, well, that was going on amongst other things, but at the top of the where they hoisted the flag at Mount Suribachi. You didn't even hear about it. It was just more activity that was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. Didn't even think much about it.
But you looked and saw it.
That saw what was going on, you know, mm-hmm. just amongst the other action.
So it didn't seem too important to you when you saw the Stars and Stripes up there?
Well, at the time, it was just somebody else doing something else on the shore. Because
mm-hmm.
most of the time, yeah, I was pretty, you're pretty busy. And I wasn't enjoying and being able to just spend my time on those long the binoculars just viewing it, the mm-hmm. action. It's what we could see and spot as we, in between what we were doing, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So was it later when you saw that famous Rosenthal photo that we've all seen and that's memorialized in bronze at Arlington now? When you saw that, did it click that, hey, I saw that flag?
I think I saw that. Yeah, that's it. I think I saw that.
Yeah.
With the action that was going on there on Mount Suribachi.
Well, of course, and people that have researched that know that there were actually two flags, and the one that the famous photos of was the second flag that was put up there. Basically, to have a better visual. So perhaps that's what you saw there on top of Mount Suribachi. Were, in that time that you spent at Iwo Jima, did you ever fear for your own life? Were you concerned that something could happen to you and your ship?
You know, that's something I never did. You know, I think at that age anyway, you think you're going to live forever anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I never thought that anything was ever going to happen. You know, never had a defeatist attitude, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You mentioned that your ship had been destined for Okinawa, but because of damage to the ship, it turned around and headed back to Pearl Harbor. Have you ever thought about what kind of difference that made for you? Because at Okinawa, there are a lot of kamikazes.
I says, I think somebody's looking after me. I says, that was even more devastating than Iwo.
Well, and particularly for ships because of the way the kamikazes attacked at Okinawa.
Yeah, that's where the air assaults were. Yeah.
But on that long journey back from Iwo Jima to Pearl Harbor, you're carrying these soldiers who had been in the fierce early fighting on Iwo.
Yeah, those that were in pretty bad shape, some of them, you know. They had to bring them aboard on gurneys and everything else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of pathetic. It kind of brought you closer to what was going on. Mm-hmm. There's another when we could see on the thing. Hey, there, that's dramatic. You know, the flamethrowers and everything. You know, was going on. That was action. But then when they started bringing the casualties back and boarded our ship, that's when you. This is no way for human beings to act. Mm. This is just not a.
It made it real for you.
That made it real.
Mm-hmm. This,
we're civilized. We're civilized. We're not supposed to be doing this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
These are people that are torn up.
You know, and that brings up a question. Did you have a concept, an idea of what you were there for? Why you were fighting this war? Why so many other guys your age were putting their lives on the line?
Anything. I think perhaps I wasn't the most intelligent person think, hey, this is what's going on. This is what you do. This is life. This is what you do. And you did it. But, you know, I never thought about the why or wherefores until afterwards. And the more I thought about after I got out, and I thought, you know, I think I lucked out.
Hmm.
Somebody must have been looking over.
No
me,
doubt.
That's pretty horrible. We don't want to go through this again.
Mm-hmm.
That's bad. Bad. Human nature, I guess, is just the way it is.
Did you ever look at those casualties, those injured soldiers dealing with, I'm sure, a wide spectrum of severity of wounds, physical and emotional, mental? Did you ever look at them and say, that could have been me?
I think probably I did. Now, you see, where they brought them on board, we were up on the bridge, mm-hmm. down on the deck where they brought him in and then went below to the ship. Never did get to see him after that. Mm. Never got to see many of the troops while they were there going.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I say, I wasn't a deckhand. I wasn't in the engineering force or anything that worked down on the level of the ship. I was always up on the bridge where we communicate and run the ship and that sort of thing. And just I was just one of the plain soldiers. I was just I was gaining stripes, but I was still just a seaman.
Mm-hmm. When you think back on it now, because these are some pretty crucial years, I think, in the development of a lot of young people. I mean, you go in when you're 18, and you celebrate your 19th birthday in the Navy. You're getting close to 20, and you're experiencing all these things that you never experienced before. When you look back, what do you think the biggest benefit to you was of your Navy service? What do you think it did for you, or how do you think it impacted your life?
Well, it certainly brought life more realistic to you.
Mm-hmm.
Living and what living really means to you. There's more than just fun and games. It's a pretty serious business. I just had one goal in mind when I got out. I just wanted to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an opportunity to play some great roles. And I played Luther Billis in South Pacific. And
you knew a thing or two about that.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you, speaking of performing, in your time in the Navy, did you ever have people perform for you? Because a lot of veterans I interview, that's what they remember.
The groups,
USO shows
yes,
and such.
Things. Yeah. And I often think, now how come I didn't get involved? I didn't know anything about that up in that small town because that was my bag.
That wasn't on the checklist for you.
But it was enjoyable, and it was a great, great relief in the strain of action and just the routine. You broke it up, and you got a few months to breathe, so to speak.
So you were on the Pickaway until the war was over?
Yeah. And then it was boredom after, because then we just, after we got back and brought the troop in and the armistice was signed, then until I got out, it was just going between the U.S. and Australia.
Do you remember when you heard that Japan had surrendered? Did that cause celebration on your ship?
Yes, and believe it or not, I couldn't get off the ship. I was on duty. Yeah.
So everybody's going ashore?
We were in San Francisco at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite the place to get that news.
Yeah. And,
but here you are stuck on the ship.
I was stuck on the ship. I had duty.
And you could probably see the lights and hear the celebration.
All the action going on over there. life wasn't really as exciting as so many guys really had,
Well, I'm sure for a lot of us listening, it's exciting enough because we haven't experienced anything like that. And there's more to discuss with Ken Green, 87 years old, a Navy veteran of World War II. We'll hear more of his adventures and remind you where you can see him in action. He's pretty energetic, isn't he, for 87 years young? We'll hear more from him when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll come down the home stretch now with Ken Green, 87 years old. He lives in Fresno, California. In fact, he and his wife, Lois, have been married for 62 years, but they never would have met had he not made it home from World War II when he served in the Navy for a couple years. None of his children or grandchildren would have ever been born. He wouldn't be performing with his daughter at New Wrinkles starting this Friday, Friday night, 7:30, over at Fresno City College, the first show for the New Wrinkles Turns Silver program. I'm going to ask Ken about what he's performing in a little bit, but let's wrap up some of this Navy stuff before we're done here. One of your regrets about your time in the Navy is that you didn't get to bring home some souvenirs you got in Manila?
Oh, yeah. I can't say that life in the Navy, when you get liberty and you have a grand time on board, you go on liberty and you were limited to what you could do. In Hawaii, we couldn't go anything but the main part of Hawaii. We couldn't go to some of the wonderful places that you could see. Mm-hmm. But the roughest one and the one that bothered me the most was we had liberty in Manila. This was shortly after the armistice was signed, but we had something to take to Manila or something. Anyway, they gave us liberty there, and the town was completely devastated, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were selling everything, the grass skirts and reminiscences of the invasion there in the Philippines. And I got me some treasures, and these were wonderful. At last, I'm going to have to show something that I had gotten in the Navy. And we went back, and of course, they brought us in on the landing barges, and mm-hmm. we got soaked coming in on it. And coming back, I did the same thing. I took my treasures and put them on my bunk, went to dry off, and I came back, and they were gone. And that was one of the most devastating things happened to me in the Navy.
Never to be seen again.
Never to be seen again. I met some very interesting guys, you know, mm-hmm. fellas that, like we call, I mentioned before, we called them old salts. Mm-hmm. They could only have been 2 or 3 years older than us, but they had been in some of the real rough times when they were defending rather than marching ahead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And these old salts had a tendency to like flower there.
Embellish a little
embellish
bit.
Embellish their, yeah. their experience. And this one, this old salt, he was very good. He was a great signalman. But he was said that, and I don't know whether it was down in the New Hebrides, wherever it was, then on board ship, and they were strafed. And he says, the guys on either side of me were killed, but it must have been when they changed the thing. And I was the only one standing, you know. And I don't know how much of that was for real, but it showed that he had so much experience. And
mm-hmm.
I said, I think this really does get to a fella. You know?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
No doubt. It's a lot to deal with.
Some of those old timers, they really, it got to them. I didn't have the experience or the time in to feel any different when I came out than when I went in, other than this is something you really got to consider. Life be a lot more serious for you. Mm-hmm. So that's about the only thing that I really took from the war.
So you were pretty motivated when you got home.
I was motivated, yeah, to find my niche in life and do contribute something to that.
And you've certainly contributed in the world of theater, and you're continuing to do so, as I mentioned. And you also gave us many years in the U.S. Postal Service, and I understand it was partly through that duty that you came to know one of Fresno's most famous sons, who's also got a bit of a name in the theater world.
Oh, you mean my buddy Bill Saroyan.
William Saroyan.
Yeah.
Fresno's
yeah.
finest.
Yeah.
How'd you get to know him?
Well, I had done 5 shows of his mm-hmm. that I have done, and I got to know him when we did, I forgot the name of it. See, there it goes again.
Time of Your Life?
Well, I was in Time of Your Life.
Yeah.
And the Cave Dwellers.
Okay.
The Cave Dwellers. And uh-huh. we had done that in the old White Theater down there, and we tried to get him to come to see it, you know. But he was overseas. But I worked at the post office, and he had a post office box there. So I talked to him, and I told him, I said, I'd had a chance to be in. So we got the chance to chat on Saturday mornings when there was a lull. He'd come in and we'd chat about his shows, which he loved to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I love to talk about being in shows, particularly some of his. Because I was in the Time of Your Life. That was a great show. Some of his stuff is really, some strange. Some of his stuff is really strange. The Cave Dwellers and the Human Comedy and a couple of others. But it was I got to know him pretty well. In fact, at one time he had he'd come in and to pick up his mail, and it wasn't any. And this was very strange for him not to have any mail. And so he was on his bicycle. And he said, well, I got it, you know, and I'd be taking off. So I found it. It was bundled up in somebody else's. So I got on the phone and, hey, Bill, I found your mail. And he said, oh, boy, he said, I can't get over that. I said, well, you know, it's printed at my lunchtime. Let me bring it over, bring it home to you. He said, I'd appreciate that. And so I drove over to his place with his bundle of mail. And here on, he'd had to go again. But on the door, he said, just leave it there, Ken. And he had a book, one of his novels, and the whole front page, he talked about he and me and our chatting at the post office before I'd go to perform. So we had a
he left you a signed book on his porch.
I got this. It's called, I used to think I could live forever, but now I'm not so sure.
Exactly. He was a fan of short, succinct titles.
Yeah. So I got to know him. A great guy.
Well, and that's my question, because I think a lot of folks, people from your generation who are around Fresno when he was still living may have those stories of him on his bicycle or curling his mustache or whatever. But, you know, many people my age and younger, they've been in the Soroyan Theater. Maybe they've seen his bus downtown. They might know that he had something to do with writing plays and writing literature, but they really don't know much about Mr. Soroyan. So give us your sense of the kind of person he was and why he is so revered here in Fresno.
He likes people, but he doesn't want people to take advantage of him, and they know he knows that they will. Somebody want this from him. Yeah. So he has tended to be a little more reserved than he really is. Very friendly person, just a great, great guy to chat with. What his contribution to the world of literature is fantastic. That's what I don't know much else I could say about him. Just that I considered him as a good friend, and probably not a close friend, but a close acquaintance.
Close enough to get the sense of the burden of fame that he carried.
Yeah. That didn't seem to bother him. He's just a normal kind of a guy that he was interested in people. He was interested in what I was doing, and that was number one. What I was that impressed me with Bill Soroyan when I had a chance to chat with him on those Saturday mornings.
Because here, and I think this is neat, and there are a lot of people over the years in whatever field they're in that have done this, but here's a guy who, you know, spent formative years in the San Joaquin Valley, achieved national, international success, but chose to live here because of the affection he felt for this part of the state. And I imagine that meant something to you.
Oh, it did. Through him, I got to be quite involved with the Armenian community. And they invited me over to some of their big shindigs, and I had the opportunity and the pleasure of playing the Fresno's first citizen in the 100-year celebration of Fresno. And I would take tours in the daytime, do the show at night, and take people around and take them through our Armenian town, show them Bill's residence and whatnot, which was a lot of fun too.
I can tell you've had a lot of fun in your life.
Oh, it's been a great life. Never made much money, but I've had a lot of fun.
And you haven't stopped having fun. That's the key.
No, as long as I can see people out there. I'm a people lover, actually.
Do you have a favorite role over all the years, all the plays?
Well, I played so many different kinds. I think I enjoyed playing Luther Billis in South Pacific. It was so much fun being that kind of guy. And then
what's your favorite song in that show?
Honey Bun.
All right.
Honey bun. That's my little honey bun. Get a load of honey bun tonight. But I think my favorite role was Ben Rumson in Paint Your Wagon.
Okay.
That one brought a lot of memories back because my mom and her parents lived in Etna because her dad and his brothers came from the area up near Sonora and
okay.
Up to the Trinities up there, you know,
yeah.
Coast Range, and settled in the valley. And so she spent a lot of her time in logging camps. And I'd go with my granddad down in the old Blake Hotel down there. They had seats down in front. And I'd go down with him and listen to the old prospectors talk about their days.
How about
gold
that?
Panning. Uh-huh. And so when I got to play the role of Ben Rumson, I think that was one of my favorite roles, and I did that in two different companies.
Outstanding. Well, I won't ask you to revisit that right now, performing-wise, but maybe you can give me a sense of what you're performing in this new Wrinkles show and how thrilled you are to be in the same show as your daughter.
Oh, yeah, this is what's a really a thrill to me because I have a daughter that takes after her paw, and her great-grandmother,
uh-huh.
who got me started. And she played Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar. And she's worked with Danny down at Good Company.
Mm-hmm. And, Dan Pisano,
so
great guy.
It's been a thrill to be able to do a show with her. The show that I chose to do was Gus the Theater Cat. And the reason I like it, Gus's life was so close to what I kind of a life that I lived. Like, I played in my time every possible part. And I used to know 70 speeches by heart and so on and so on. But that's mm-hmm. part of our
Gus the Theater Cat.
Gus the Theater Cat.
So if you head over to the New Wrinkles Show at Fresno City College, opening night is this Friday. It runs all weekend and all the way through June the 9th, you can see Gus the Theater Cat.
And it's a pleasure playing with him. There's some great talent that's
uh-huh.
performing.
What's your daughter doing?
She plays Jolly Rama. And she's this is Gus.
Mm-hmm.
His name is really Asparagus. But we call him just Gus. And she tells about him. Well, I wander around with the audience and everybody. Yeah, you know, uh-huh. have a lot of fun with it. And then I come in and tell my story of what I've been. So,
Very fun.
But she tells a little bit about Gus to introduce him that then tells his story. And it's a good number. It's a good number. I've always wanted to play it. Good Company did a great job with it. Steve Pepper played the role that I'm playing now.
Well, you seem to be ready to perform it with a bit of gusto, if I
yes.
can say.
Yeah. The show must go on.
Not to be confused with Asparagusto.
Right.
I guess I have to ask. I guess I'm a broken record with the questions I ask on this show because I ask everyone about Pearl Harbor. I ask everyone about the end of the war. And if they're still doing something, if they're really active, I always have to ask, how long are you going to keep doing this? So how long are you going to keep performing and acting and doing the things you're doing?
Wherever they can use an 88-year-old man. yeah, that was one of my greatest achievements, was playing old men when I was young.
Oh, yeah.
And now that I can play old men, they hire young men to play the roles.
And they won't hire you to play a young man.
Oh, there are not too many roles that are open now for me. Oh, there's a few roles I'd love to play. But it's harder and harder now to retain that many lines in a show and remember while I'm up there what I'm doing and why I'm there and what I'm talking about, which is really amazing that we've been able to chat here, and I've been able to chat with you a little bit and still be a little.
And you've only gone over to about three different characters, and then
yeah,
you've always come back to Ken, so it's perfect. Well, I guess as we wrap things up, is there anything else about the new Wrinkles show that you think we ought to know?
It's one of the few, well, there's only about one or two other shows of senior citizens that have continued going for 25 years.
And you've been with New Wrinkles since it started?
Well, it's been about the last 8 or 9 years that I decided I wanted to do something else. And
mm-hmm.
So I was a drama minister and did shows, Good Shepherd Family Theater.
Uh-huh.
And I direct shows.
At the Good Shepherd Lutheran Church here in Fresno.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I haven't been doing really very much. They want me to do another show out there, and I'm thinking of doing Hansel and Gretel. Anyway, that'll be this summer. So
well, witches always go over well in churches. So,
oh, yeah.
So good luck with that.
Yeah.
Although the moral of that story is a good one. So, well, I guess as we close, Ken, I should bring it back around. Here you were one of the more than 16 million Americans in uniform during World War II. And you did come home, and you've had this life that you're still enjoying and living life to the fullest today. So when you look back on all that, what are you most thankful for?
I think just being thankful that I've been able to be amongst friendly people. Being a human being is quite an achievement in itself. I think people are some of the greatest things, and just being amongst them. I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't be amongst people.
It's been an entertaining hour with you, Ken. Thank you so much, first of all, for serving our country, for telling us about that and your colorful life. And I hope a lot of people come out and see Gus the Theater Cat.
I think they'll thoroughly enjoy it. Great group of people. And they're not all professional actors. They're people that like to perform. And there's a lot of talent. It's a pleasure to be working with them.
Well, I know I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Hope you at home have too. Ken Green, 87 years old, of Fresno, California. Catch him at Fresno City College in the production New Wrinkles Turn Silver. I have that information linked on our website at kmjnow.com. The show opens Friday. It runs all the way through June the 9th. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District Building, the Sounds of Freedom Military Concert Band is performing a free Armed Forces Day concert. I said it's free, and that's at 2 o'clock in Clovis. They are great, so take advantage of that. And be back with me next Saturday at 1 o'clock when we meet a 90-year-old retired teacher and longtime basketball referee who was aboard the USS Hornet when Doolittle's Raiders took off and who was wounded during the sinking of the Hornet. It's quite a story, and we'll hear it next Saturday at 1 in the next installment of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.